Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want to listen, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking to Peter Hart, who is with Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, FAIR, and he's the co-host of the show Counterspin, which airs here on KSFR, and we're going to be talking about some of the ideas that are circulating during this presidential election season. Right now, I would like to welcome the residents from the Santa Fe Art Institute, three of the residents. The open studios that they have every month are tomorrow night at 5:30 at the Art Institute. Welcome to the Radio Cafe. We have Gordon Sasaki, Chris Clark, and Caroline Kelly. Welcome.
Thank you.
Hello.
So, Chris Clark, you are from New Orleans, born and raised there, and you are one of the last residents at the Santa Fe Art Institute who's part of the post-Katrina art residency program. Tell us about your artistic life before and after Katrina.
I had never ever lived any place other than New Orleans until Hurricane Katrina. And I evacuated to Dallas, Texas, stayed there for 2 years, and just went home to New Orleans 11 months ago.
Is that right?
And because I lived in the Upper Ninth Ward, I wasn't allowed to return home until October. And when I did return home, what struck me the most about the city was that all the color was gone. New Orleans is a subtropical environment, and so we've got flowers all year long. We have azaleas that bloom in December. And everything was had a wash of a grayish brown on it, and it was stunning to me. And I walked around in shock like the rest of the residents of New Orleans, and I just started unconsciously picking up leaves that I found on the ground. I knew I had to go back to Dallas. I knew I couldn't stay, but I had to bring something back with me. So I picked up the leaves from my city, and I brought them back to the loft that I was staying in Dallas, and I placed them on a table, and I just left them there for weeks. And as an artist, I felt it was important for me to make a statement about what had happened to me, to the city, to our people. And so at first, I was taking photographs from the newspaper and making narratives, but they were too sentimental and they were too, it was too much emotion coming from me, and they weren't doing what I needed them to do. And I was having trouble sleeping. And so I was pacing around the studio one night at 3 a.m. and the narratives were sitting on the easel and around the loft. And all of a sudden I looked at the leaves and I looked at the narratives and I realized that one of the leaves was the exact same shape as a dead body floating in the water.
Good heavens.
And it was the same shape as a woman who had her hand to her face. And I started realizing that the leaves were as figurative as the images that I was making. And then I realized that the leaves became a symbol for change that we had all gone through, for death that we had all experienced. And so, even though I've been a figurative artist since I was a little girl, I started doing a series of leaves. And then I took leaves from New Orleans and did paintings from New Orleans. I took leaves from Dallas, did leaves from Dallas. Got an art residency in the south of France, did the same thing. And now that I'm here in New Mexico, I'm continuing the process.
And so you draw and paint these leaves, and what happens inside of you? I mean, what is this process doing for you?
Well, I mean, for me as an artist, I don't have any gimmicks. There are no tricks. I mean, my first love is drawing, to be honest. I mean, people say I'm good with color, but I think I'm a product of my environment.
Well, I was when you said the color was missing, and having looked at some of your work, which does seem to have a very deep sense of color, it must have been very strange to see a city that was sort of, I thought you actually meant not only visual color, but local color, so to speak.
No, everything had a wash of gray-brown on it.
Just dirt.
It was an extraordinary experience for me. I'd never, ever seen my city look like that. And then the other most profound effect that I'll never forget, ever, as long as I live, is that our doors were marked. There were big X's on our doors. All of our doors, all of our apartments had been entered by rescuers looking for dead bodies or looking for people that were trapped. So when you went home, the first thing you saw was the lack of color. The second thing you saw was the devastation everywhere. And the third thing you saw on your door was a big X. And there were the initials of the state that the rescuer came from, the date that he entered, and whether there were dead bodies or not.
Now, was your house flooded?
No. In the Upper Ninth Ward, it didn't flood. But because I lived in a camelback double, which is very typical for New Orleans architecture, it was over 100 years old. And so the hurricane blew an 8-foot hole in the back of the house. And then we were visited by a second hurricane that came along 3 weeks later, and it flooded my house. It flooded the back of the house.
And so are you now able to return to live in the same house?
No. I was a happy renter. I had never owned a house in New Orleans. You could live in New Orleans cheaply as an artist. That's over. The rents are now 3 times higher than they were. There's an extreme housing shortage. But I always had a fabulous apartment, either in the French Quarter or in the Faubourg Marigny.
So what are you working on at the Art Institute? What are people going to see when they come and visit the Institute for the Open Studios?
I continued my process since Katrina on this journey that I've been on. And I walked around and looked at the landscape and started selecting leaves. The city is beautiful. It's filled with angles, and the foliage, the flowers are sharp and pointy. And so I just started to select things that I don't censor what I select.
So what do you think is the role of art, both for you personally and then on a community level, in a post-disaster world, in a post-Katrina world, in your case?
To document. I mean, I think it's the same for everyone. To document the time that we're in, socially, culturally, historically, just to document what's happening. I mean, I think I feel strongly that it's my responsibility to make a commentary. And it is a personal commentary that I hope has a universal connection. I mean, you know, New Orleans is not the first devastated city. Now I realize it was just our turn. So you know, I had to comment.
Chris Clark's work can be seen tomorrow night at the Santa Fe Art Institute Open Studios, which begins at 5:30. I'd like now to turn to Gordon Sasaki. He is originally from Hawaii, now lives in New York City. Welcome.
Thank you.
You also have kind of a pre and post disaster, I suppose, in your work, because you suffered the effects of a devastating car accident.
Yes, I did.
How did that affect your work, and how did you work with that for yourself? I don't know if you would say for your own healing or for your own art making.
Well, I guess perhaps I should just kind of clarify, because it's obviously not apparent on the radio format, is that I am in a wheelchair. I broke my back about in the mid-sternum area, which is actually technically T7. This was while I was studying art in college. It was a life-altering experience where really my life changed completely overnight, literally. But through the process of just kind of finding myself, I've used art as a means to not only kind of understand how I engage with the world, but how how we all kind of interconnect. One of the things that I think is dominant in my work is the work really surrounds the body. It includes and incorporates the body. So some of the work that I will be showing at the Open Studios will be some straight portraits. I've been working on some photographs of artists in New York City for maybe the past 2.5 years. And pretty much just making pseudo-documentary photos of them.
Pseudo-documentary?
Yeah.
What do you mean?
Well, one of the things that I'm interested in using photography for is rather than a description of the outside world, I'm really interested in how it has the ability to construct the outside world or the reality. So that's my intent with these photos.
So you one of the, as I was looking at your work online, clothing is a theme. Is that right?
Yes, indeed, yes.
Tell us about that work.
That was a body of work that I made, a hand-sewn, life-size rice paper. I have no idea how to sew. I teach myself how to sew it. The process really, it really made me respect people who take the two-dimensional form and change it into a three-dimensional shape. Tailors, for example. I mean, it really is, it had a lot to do with geometry and math, and I found it very interesting.
It also, when you were talking about the human body and having to deal with how your life changed so quickly, it seems like clothing is something you wrap around yourself and almost in the way that flesh is something that's wrapped around yourself.
Exactly, right. And that was part of the intent of using rice paper because of its translucency. And you know, at the same time, clothing is a form that we use to not only cover ourselves and protect ourselves, but also a means of representation of the self.
So, what are you interested in now? Oh, I wanted to ask you, you are from Hawaii originally. How does your Hawaiian heritage, if it does, play into the work that you do?
I think it does. Invariably, it just kind of pops its head up here and there, and I'm not consciously aware of it. I'm just working. Invariably, I mean, we're all parts of our environment, right?
So it's hard to say what that actually looks like when it comes up?
Well, I really don't set out to include those type of elements in my work. It just happens.
So what are you working on now at the Institute?
Well, like I was saying, I'm going to be showing these photos that I'm printing here. And I might be showing a few other photos if I can get things together and get some images printed.
Have you been photographing people in Santa Fe?
I have indeed, yes. I've shot all of the artists at the Institute as well as the staff. And I've created this kind of goofy QuickTime movie that I might be showing as well. Yeah.
Gordon Sasaki's work will be shown tomorrow night at the Santa Fe Art Institute. 5:30 is when it all begins. And I'd like now to turn to Caroline Kelly. Welcome, Caroline.
Thank you.
Tell us about your work. Where are you from originally?
I grew up in Massachusetts on Martha's Vineyard, but I've lived all over the place. I just was in Los Angeles for 2 years. And I'm on my way to Sweden after this.
And what kind of work do you do?
I'm sort of new to talking about my artwork. I have a background in academia. And so my work right now is sort of a melange of the research that I was doing for my PhD.
What was that about?
I did research on the Algerian Revolution and women's participation in it.
Really? Can you just tell us a little bit about that?
I studied women's life writing, their autobiographical writing, about their militant participation in the War of Independence in Algeria. So...
And so did you end up getting your PhD, or did you...
I just finished my dissertation.
Good. Wow. And so how does that feed into the visual art that you're doing?
Well, right now I'm doing a lot of, I'm trying to combine the scholarly research that I'm interested in doing with writing and with more conceptual, I guess, conceptually based art. And so I'm doing a piece right now about the way that war is reimagined and represented. And it takes the form of a site-specific installation.
How is war reimagined and reinvented? Tell us more what you mean by that.
Well, I don't want to get too heavy on the radio show, but I'm looking at these theories by a French theorist named Guy Debord, who wrote on the idea of the society of the spectacle and the way that we turn things into commodities. And so I'm sort of interested in the way that radicalism and especially revolution or war is reimagined and sort of assimilated into a capitalist society.
It's hard to imagine how war can become a commodity. Although I suppose from the point of view of the arms manufacturers, you could see it that way.
I guess I took for inspiration the idea of Che and the way that Che has become sort of a symbol, but he's not particularly well known as a historical. The details of his actual biography or his actual personality or what he actually did are not widely known, but he's a symbol
at
on
least
t-shirts.
Here.
Right. Exactly. He's a symbol we see on t-shirts and posters, and so I was sort of interested in exploring that in art.
Right. Yeah, the whole realm of conceptual art is interesting and tricky, because for those who are, you know, walking in off the street into a building and they see something and it doesn't have an explanation, you know, how do you make sure that the viewer is on the same page as the whole thought process that you've been going through?
I think hopefully that my work could be read on many different levels, and maybe if somebody saw it and wanted to learn more about the history of it, specifically what I'm doing right now is based on the Algerian Revolution. It takes the Algerian Revolution as its specific context, but people could see it also on another level and wouldn't necessarily need to know the history about it, hopefully, to interact with it or enjoy it, I guess. So
the three of you are working as residents at the Santa Fe Art Institute. What's the conversation like? I mean, one of the things that's so great about residencies is that you get to interact with one another and learn from one another and be inspired. What does that look like this time around?
The core of our conversation is food. but oddly enough, that stimulates great conversation, because once people come to a table to eat together, it's a very intimate act. It's so New Orleans for me. I mean, that's how we socialize. We sit down to eat together, and one person will cook and share all the food with whoever shows at the table. And so once you are in that intimate setting and you're relaxed and you start to be silly and talk, then great ideas come about. Great ideas and discussion about art does come about.
What is it like for you, Gordon, at home? What is your artistic community like?
Well, I live in New York City, and primarily most of my friends are all some type of artists of some type. So, everything that I do, every aspect of my life is kind of very much an art process. This is one of the things that I feel is very important. I don't really try and make a distinction between what I make or what I do and my work. I feel like being an artist is how you engage with the world, the way you perceive the world. And it doesn't necessarily have to mean about making anything. So this is what I...
It's so interesting that you say that, because your work is so beautiful. It's so visually, richly beautiful.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I mean, that's one of the things that I kind of play around with in terms of even how we begin to define beauty. Beauty itself is, in a way, a construction of just our mental state or societal perspectives. So these are some of the things that I address in my work.
Do you think so? You don't think it's like a universal human perception?
Well, given the fact that it changes from period to period and from culture to culture, I would have to say that it's largely a construction. There are kind of psychological analysis about, you know, symmetry and other aspects that we can kind of empirically define beauty as, but no, I don't think so.
Very interesting.
I think it's very much a just.
So, how do you actually explore that in your work, like those that kind of question?
That's exactly what I do. It changes. I work in a variety of media. It just depends on my particular interest at that point. And I'm always exploring different things, very much like I guess a scientist would explore different ideas. And they're not all successes. Most of them are failures, but, you know, I just play around.
Well, all of this and much, much more will be at the Santa Fe Art Institute tomorrow evening at 5:30. And the Santa Fe Art Institute is on the campus of the College of Santa Fe. So it's if you would like more information, the number is 424-5050. And you can also check them out on the web at sfai.org. Chris Clark, Caroline Kelly, and Gordon Sasaki, we will see you tomorrow. And if people have more questions for you, I guess they can talk to you then as well.
Thank you.
Wonderful.
We're going to take a little break right now. We will be right back. Stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome, joining us by telephone, Peter Hart. He is Activism Director at FAIR, which is Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, and he's co-host and producer of FAIR's radio show, Counterspin, which airs on KSFR on Sunday afternoons at 3:30. He's the author of the book, The O'Reilly Factor, Unspinning Fox News Channel's Bill O'Reilly. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
My pleasure to be here.
So you've been looking at the framing of the 2008 presidential campaign, and you've been deconstructing some of the themes in the media conversation about the candidates, and one of them is the self-identification of Senator John McCain as Maverick. And first of all, I think it's interesting that here we are in New Mexico, the origin of the word Maverick is a southwestern term. It refers to 19th century Texas cattleman and land baron Samuel Augustus Maverick, who didn't brand his cattle. So the term actually means unbranded range animal, and especially a calf that has been separated from its mother. Now, how do you connect that to the John McCain as Maverick concept?
I'm not sure an unbranded cattle is going to line up with John McCain ever. And I'm not sure the other meaning of the term really matches up with John McCain either. This, I think, started up in 97 or 98 as McCain's national profile was rising and it looked like he was going to be a possible presidential contender. And McCain, with the assist of the National Press Corps, branded this Arizona senator, who at that point was a fairly reliable conservative Republican, as someone who was willing to buck his party and cross party lines, the kind of thing that you hear endlessly about John McCain now. And, you know, I think right after 2000, you could make a plausible case for maybe 18 months. John McCain did behave like a maverick, probably because he was still stinging from the loss in the primaries to George Bush. But before then and since then, he's been a pretty reliable conservative member of the Senate, and some years one of the most conservative members of the Senate based on the tallies of votes that different folks do. The interesting thing about this is that the media kind of helped create this storyline for him, and they're having a hard time letting go of it. And that's what explains some of the anguished coverage of McCain over the last couple of months. There are a lot of pundits who had a lot invested in John McCain and who are wondering why he's campaigning in such a way that kind of cuts against this mythic status they've attached to him over the years. And it's kind of bizarre to watch, because McCain is doing exactly what politicians do. He's trying to win by any means necessary in an election, and these pundits believe that John McCain is someone that he's not, so they're having a hard time understanding reality.
When you refer to pundits, who are you referring to?
This is a rather small group of columnists and TV analysts that you see on CNN, Fox, MSNBC, and in some of the big papers, the Washington Post pundits, Newsweek magazine, Time magazine. So people like Joe Klein and Howard Feynman and Richard Cohen, to name three very, I think, influential and very, until recently, very enthusiastic supporters of McCain, who have all, in one form or another, made a break with him because he's stopped being the imaginary maverick that they said he was.
So the maverick, besides being the motherless calf, refers to somebody who really is an independent thinker who stands outside of his group, whether that be political party or whatever. Are there examples of where John McCain actually has been that?
Well, John McCain likes to cite climate change, torture, and campaign finance. Campaign finance is probably the only good example, really. Torture, he's rhetorically been critical, but his voting record isn't that strong. And the same is true of climate change. It's a kind of a mixed bag. I think there have been some years where his rating among environmental groups, the groups that rate politicians, hasn't been that bad. But overall, it's a pretty typical, I think, Southwest Republican record. So I think it's more of a... you know, to be honest, it's more of a cultural difference, if anything else. The media, who I think got on the bus with McCain in the year 2000, appreciated the fact that he was more open and more candid in a way, and that allowed them, I think, to feel like they could write this story about John McCain being a different kind of politician. You know, to be honest, I don't think they really know what it means, other than the fact that John McCain is the kind of guy who, at least until recently, would sit in the back of his bus and just chat with reporters. And it's very unusual for a major political candidate to do. And that helped cultivate this relationship with the media that has helped him for a long time. And only until recently, I think, has the coverage been consistently critical of McCain, because his actions, I think, have probably warranted it. But he had a lot of goodwill built up with the press corps that it looks like he's slowly squandered.
Another theme that we've heard for quite a long time is that the word elite or elitist is disparaging in some way. First of all, what's wrong with having an elite education? How has that become a negative? You know, what's wrong with striving to be really good at what you do?
Yeah, it's this bizarre kind of contradictory conversation that the media have, and I think it's because the Republicans push the line, or some conservative pundits and commentators push the line as well, that there's something wrong with being an elitist. And different people have written about this. Tom Frank and Jeff Nunberg have written about the history of this term, and elitist used to mean you were a member of the financial elite, you know, the bankers and the landowners that in a sense kind of ran the country. And over the last 20 years, it's been turned into a word that has a kind of cultural meaning. You enjoy listening to national public radio, and you drive a certain kind of car, and you eat certain kinds of foods, and it's really a sneering description of people who I guess are a little bit more cosmopolitan. And I think that's the way the media have allowed it to be used, and in some cases have used it themselves against Barack Obama. And for people who think elitism in terms of economic or political power, you think, well, here you have two candidates. One was raised by a single mom, sometimes on welfare, and after his education took a job as a community organizer. The other was born into an elite military family and married a multi-million dollar beer heiress who, you know, sits atop a family fortune. Which one of those candidates is elitist? Well, apparently it's the former, not the latter. And it says something, I think, really profound about the way we've mangled the term elitist, and we've I think stripped it of any of its original meaning, and have attributed this kind of weak, shallow liberalism to it, when in reality I think it has very little to do with being an elitist, and maybe, as you said, more to do with being kind of thoughtful and educated, which I suppose is something one could be guilty of, but it's hard to see how it's a problem.
It seems like the term has been used to just drive a wedge between Democratic politicians and the working class, or let's say lower end of the economic spectrum constituencies that they represent.
Yeah, I think it has a real power in that sense, because your problem, if you're a Democratic presidential candidate trying to connect with those voters, is trying to convey that you understand their concerns. And when the media latch onto this storyline, which is what it is, to suggest that you don't live like the rest of America, then that can be a tremendous problem to you. And the circumstances were always so bizarre, Obama makes this campaign about bitter rural voters, and suddenly everything becomes a proof of his elitism. He ordered orange juice at a diner instead of coffee. He doesn't bowl well. He went to play pool one time. Well, pool is kind of an elitist sport even. He went to visit his grandmother in Hawaii, and that was considered an elitist vacation spot. Everything he did for a period of the campaign, it seemed, could be branded elitist. And, you know, it was hard to understand what on earth they were talking about, but that storyline the Republicans were trying to make stick, and I think they were very successful with no small help from the media.
It does seem to bespeak a dearth of actual ideas on the Republican side that they're focusing on things like orange juice.
I think it's two things. I think they understand they can win elections focusing on these quasi-cultural issues, and I think the press corps has more fun talking about them than talking about policy debates. Joe the Plumber is an interesting phenomenon in the media, not because it's provoking us to have a thoughtful debate about tax policy. It should, and it could, but it's not. It's a character, and we're having a good time because he's a sort of stand-in for regular America, or at least what the media determined to be regular America. And we're getting back to that elitist argument, that obviously this is someone who's more comfortable with McCain than Barack Obama. That's the message of this storyline over and over again. The fact that, according to his own stated goals with this plumbing business and his own finances, he would likely do better under an Obama tax plan than a McCain tax plan. Well, that's less important. The more important thing here is that we have something we can talk about now. And I think it's a sort of a powerful lesson in how this imagery can swamp actual information. We did a study at FAIR early part of the primary season, and there was something like 5% of the network news stories about the election were about actual policy. The New York Times ombudsman just did his own study of the New York Times, and it's something closer to 10%, so twice as bad as the awful 5% in the New York Times. The media doesn't have a vested interest in talking about these things very often. It's a lot easier for them, apparently, to talk about polls and fundraising and strategy and tactics and this kind of diversionary stuff, because the other election news, I suppose, would be either dull or would be inconvenient for them.
It does seem to me that they often try to handicap the lesser candidate. In other words, try to make it into an even horse race when it really isn't at all. And when you look at for example, the candidacy of Sarah Palin, one thing that I found extraordinary is that it's often said that she has the same amount of experience or more experience than Barack Obama. Now, Barack Obama is a constitutional scholar, a deep thinker, more intelligent than just about anybody I've ever known, with a great deal of political experience from local to national, while it's clear just from watching Sarah Palin speak that she's now talking about things she's never thought about before, and yet they're framed as comparable. It's hard to understand that, except that they're trying to make an uneven situation falsely even.
Yeah, we like to talk about false balance sometimes, where, especially after a debate, the media will try to do a fact check. And the general rule for the press is to pretend that the infractions are more or less equal to both sides. So in a Biden-Palin debate, you have to find two Biden misstatements or exaggerations and two Palin misstatements or exaggerations. The you know, the lesson from a report like that, of course, is that they're more or less even. And I think the interesting thing about Palin has been the curve that she's been graded on. I think, you know, there was some shock at the announcement of her as McCain's running mate, and I think some people inside the Beltway media were a little disturbed by the fact that McCain picked someone from outside their circle. The more disturbing thing, of course, is whether or not what she's saying makes any sense. And, you know, the press have kind of admitted the game every so often by explaining that these campaign events and especially debates are really about expectations, and you set expectations very low and then you hope that a candidate exceeds expectations. You know, that's sort of the game of campaign journalism. So I think with Sarah Palin in her debate with Biden and in other settings, the expectation is that she's probably going to fall on her face, and if she doesn't, then she's sort of won. So anyone who watched the Biden-Palin debate would probably conclude that she might seem like an interesting character, but she clearly didn't have the same grasp of the facts. That's not the way the pundits grade these events. They're grading them based on their own sort of internal monitor of what Palin should say or shouldn't say. She's still not given an actual press conference and answered questions on the fly about any number of issues, which is rather extraordinary. She's talked to reporters in spots here and there, but they know clearly that she's not going to do a good job of this. The experience has already borne them out. And we kind of pretend that we don't know that. I think that's the lesson the media has taught us, that we're just going to assume that things are moving along okay. And I think it's a real fundamental indictment of the system as it works. The media, I think, have a certain amount invested in the status quo and can't really allow for the fact or allow for the suspicion that this is a fundamentally unqualified and unserious person who's could possibly be the vice president. That would suggest a real damning indictment of the political process, and that's not what the media is in the business of doing or offering.
We're talking to Peter Hart from FAIR. I do think that recent Newsweek article did address some of the issues that you're talking about, and I don't have a quotation in front of me, mm-hmm. but it basically said you don't necessarily want your president or vice president to be just like you. You want them to be somebody who's competent.
Yeah, and I think the media have come around to this. There was a Newsweek story about a month ago that was much different about Sarah Palin, and it sort of suggests that, you know, it's taken them a while to work up the courage to write this, because that story was, there was one line in that Newsweek piece in September that said that Palin is like an action figure, breast pump in hand, baby on her hip, dressed in a power suit and standing at a microphone giving Democrats hell. That was a different Sarah Palin that they saw. I think they've, as is often the case with the media, they've looked at the polling and they're kind of lagging behind the public. The public was interested in Sarah Palin and became almost immediately much less interested and much less favorably disposed toward her. And the media, I think, is catching up and understanding that, you know what, the public might be onto something, that there is not a Palin mania sweeping the nation. People were intrigued by her appearance on the national scene, and the more they hear from her, the less apparently they like.
So one thing that I think your organization has for many years been looking at is the extent to which this whole media thing is in itself a spectacle. I mean, I had an acquaintance who characterized the vice presidential debate as Sarah Palin auditioning for her own reality show. It's a very strange thing where it becomes not about, I mean, essentially the campaign process should be one giant extended job interview that the voters get to make a decision about, but instead it's some other kind of media spectacle.
Yeah, and you know, occasionally we peek behind the curtain and see how things are actually running, and it's illuminating, if not a little bit distressing. I was watching this Al Jazeera English report about people who attended Palin rallies, and they were basically going to one of them and interviewing people in attendance who were Palin supporters, and it was remarkable the kind of things that you heard them saying. Obama's a terrorist, we can't vote for a Muslim, on and on and on, all kinds of nastiness. And I think the media have done a pretty good job of suggesting that stuff is out there, but not broadcasting it or not delving into it very deeply. And here was an example of an outlet that did. And I think that bringing that to light would be useful. I think the press is at a loss over what to make of something like Sarah Palin because they don't understand it. They don't understand why it makes any sense. They got whipped up in the frenzy just like the McCain campaign did, apparently. And I think now there's sort of there are hard truths that they're confronting. And I think part of it is because the media didn't decide to scrutinize her record very closely right away. And part of the reason they didn't was because the right deployed a very familiar strategy where you bash the media for quote-unquote attacking your side immediately, long before there were any actual attacks. And by doing that, you hope that the media pull back, they pull their punches, and I think in the case of Palin, that's exactly what happened. So you've seen, I think, some very strange dynamics in the race at this point, to the point where now you're not sure whether you're watching Sarah Palin on Saturday Night Live or somebody doing an impression of Sarah Palin on Saturday Night Live. The whole process has gotten kind of hard to parse, and I think voters are understandably dismayed. And, you know, the thing you hear most from people, I suspect, is that they're tired of hearing from the candidates and they're tired of hearing about the candidates. I think what they're really tired of is the kind of campaign coverage we get that's trivial and nonsensical and obsessed with all the wrong things.
To what extent do you think the independent media, such as Democracy Now! And even a lot of internet media, are making a difference in shaping people's opinions about the campaign and also giving them the kind of information that you're talking about being missing from the campaign?
I think the more important thing is probably the latter. You know, the independent media aren't reaching enough, as many people as CNN or other corporate media outlets, but the people they are reaching are getting a very different idea of the candidates. So if you're listening to Democracy Now! Or in some cases watching it, you saw Ralph Nader and Cynthia McKinney participate in kind of a virtual debate with Obama and McCain last week. That was really interesting. You're hearing critical scholars and writers talk about the areas on which McCain and Obama don't differ that much, primarily on foreign policy, Mideast policy, Pakistan, things like that. The differences kind of get blurry, if non-existent. So I think those are really interesting and helpful outlets in the sense that they give people a very different kind of campaign coverage. And, you know, you have to think that for the hours that are spent talking about the campaign, there's no reason that any outlet can't do these things, but they don't. And I think that's the real shame, that there's always time in the day to talk about the independent candidates for president. There's always time to break off part of your broadcast and talk about specific issues and how the candidates agree or disagree on them. But the corporate media don't do that. They tend to prefer a kind of politics as horse race or sporting event model, which I think makes it more interesting for them to cover, but less educational for voters.
I have been watching lately Jim Lehrer's NewsHour, and they have had Ralph Nader and the Libertarian candidate and people like that on. Where do you think that the public TV and public radio, what kind of a job do you think they're doing?
Yeah, I just finished actually writing a piece for our website that hopefully will be up in the next couple of minutes about third-party coverage. And, you know, to the extent that Barr, Nader, and Cynthia McKinney, to take three prominent examples, to the extent they're covered, it's mostly as a distraction or a diversion, whether or not they're going to be spoilers, this and that. But the NewsHour has devoted the time to interviewing both Nader and and Barr in the last week, and there was actually a segment about Nader yesterday on the NBC Nightly News that was not about those things and was actually about the issues. So there is time to do these things, and I think there's always more time. Public broadcasting, from our studies over the years of different things, public broadcasting tends to be more similar than different from the corporate media, particularly the news hour and the main news programs on National Public Radio. A lot of the same sources, a lot of the same people are quoted. I think that they have generally the same kind of priorities as the corporate media. This is one of those areas where PBS, I think, should be applauded for at least deciding that they're going to give up some of that time to talking to some of these other candidates. And I think that's in the public interest, and that's at the very minimum what we should expect from public broadcasting.
You mentioned a few minutes ago that Al Jazeera English had reported on a story. Do you follow at FAIR the English language versions of the foreign press, or the English language, for example, press from England and Australia and so on, and compare them to United States press coverage?
Not all the time, but when you do the comparisons, particularly with the British press, it's usually striking. On the one hand, it's a difference in tone. They're much more critical in direct interviews with their politicians and their political leaders, and that's very jarring, I think, for American television viewers. And I think generally the coverage is more critical in a kind of broad sense, that there's I think, less fear of pulling back and getting off of the horse race. I think you have a different kind of political or election coverage from the foreign press because they're not as invested in the day-to-day ups and downs of the polling and that kind of thing. They're looking at big picture, broad strokes, what's going to change in the world if one of these people is elected president. And in that sense, I think a lot of their attention is focused on trade policy and foreign policy, and those are the areas where I think, honestly, Obama and McCain don't differ all that much. They're still caught up in the spectacle of the election, but I think they look at it from a healthy distance, and it's useful, I think, for Americans to, if they have the time, to read that kind of writing, because it tends to be a bit more critical, and I think there's a certain kind of perspective that is welcome after, you know, spending a day watching CNN or something like that.
Yeah, we carry the BBC on this station, and it is definitely a different flavor than even National Public Radio in terms of the kind of coverage it has of U.S. issues. I do feel that this election, compared to the last two elections, has a different tone to it. For example, negative campaigning isn't working in the way that it has worked in the past, and there seems to be a more serious and realistic examination of issues, even despite all of that you've said, perhaps because of the economic crisis that is at hand. What's your perspective on that?
Yeah, I think reality has intruded on the sort of typical campaign narrative. It's amazing to think that we could have considered 2004 a year when there weren't as many big issues, but in a way, I think you're right. I think between the financial meltdown and the mortgage crisis and wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, just to name four things, there's a lot more to talk about. And I think the campaigns have tried to focus on these things because they sort of have to. So in that context, talking about how well Barack Obama knows Bill Ayers strikes voters as kind of absurd. And you haven't seen as aggressive a campaign from outside 527 groups to push the connection. They're just not having as much traction. That's not to say it's not working entirely, but I think it's in the corners of the media where you'd expect it to be. So Fox News Channel is focusing on Ayers almost to the fault of everything else, it seems, some nights. You do see distractions pop up. This whole Acorn voter registration fraud controversy is very big on Fox. It's very big on CNN, very big on Lou Dobbs' show. Almost entirely a non-story, but it's something that these people are pushing, either conservatives in the media or Republican strategists themselves, to try to suggest, I think, in the long run, that there is something suspicious about the outcome of this election. I think that's their intent, and they're having a lot of success in getting that message out into the media. So on balance, I think it's probably a more substantive election, but, you know, that's not saying much.
Peter Hart is the activism director at FAIR and co-host and producer of FAIR's radio show Counterspin, which airs on KSFR on Sunday afternoons at 3:30. Thanks so much for being with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
My pleasure.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can reach me at radiocafe@ksfr.org by email or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want to listen, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Marilyn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz presents Rolf Liebermann's Concerto for Jazz Band and Symphony Orchestra. Broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. We will see you tomorrow. Ciao.